For seven decades, his unforgettable voice reached millions of fans at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and his dramatic signature calls helped make the Indianapolis 500 the greatest spectacle that it became. Born Carl Kanegi, he overcame a physical handicap as a young man and rode the power of his vocal cords through state oratory contests, a radio job in Fort Wayne, and finally a job in Indianapolis in 1946. Through a quirk of fate, being in the right place at the right time, he was offered the chance to become the public address announcer at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and held on to it for 61 years. He also broadcast countless basketball games, including the state high school tournament, and was a fixture on local television as the sports director at Channel 6. Never making excuses for his physical disability, he went on to compete in senior swimming events, and he left his mark as a founder of the state's Basketball Hall of Fame. I'm Mark Monteith, and in a rebroadcast of an episode first brought to you in May of 2009, I'm going one-on-one with Tom Kanegi.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever. Pita Pit, have you had your pita today?
Tom, I know you grew up in Connecticut. Was born.
Not really. I was born in Connecticut, but I was just born, and then my father was a Baptist minister. He had just graduated from Colgate Rochester Divinity School. So that was his first little church that he had. And then we lived in Pontiac, Michigan, Waterloo, Iowa, Kansas City, Missouri. And then I graduated from William Jewell College and applied for jobs. I wrote letters, told them I was interested in radio. And I got an affirmative answer from Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I think they hired everybody that could say their call letters, W-O-W-O, and say it properly. But that's where I got my start, essentially. Then 3 years later, after working with them, got a call from Eugene Pulliam, who owned the Indianapolis Star and had a radio station. We were on the ninth floor of the studios of the Claypool Hotel. Accepted the job and lived in Fort Wayne, in Indianapolis ever since.
Right. Growing up, did you have interest in broadcasting as a child?
Yes, I did, a little bit. To get through college, I needed an extracurricular activity because I had become partially paralyzed with a polio-type problem. And I needed to do something with my voice and oratory. The American Legion had an Americanism contest every year. And I entered that, and extemporaneous speaking as well as a prepared speech. And I finished fourth in the state as a freshman or a sophomore.
In Missouri?
In Missouri.
Oh, okay.
As a senior, I won it. Total prize money is $125. So I took that and went to college. And of course, continued with debate work and speaking, theater. And our group entered me in a contest that took place in Ohio. And radio speaking was on the agenda. I entered that, won the contest, and that was when it triggered my thought that radio was the place to go.
Were you athletic growing up? Did you like
sports? Oh, yeah, I played baseball, a lot of baseball, and also played tackle in football. But then on my junior year, I became ill. When I came back, I just couldn't participate anymore.
How did you get polio? I know it was a common thing then, but do you know how does one contract?
I don't know. It was
polio.
I said polio type when I told you. The doctor really never knew. And I was in the hospital for 4 or 5 months recovering. And so you know what that does to your facilities. And walking, I had a foot drop and still have it, and I've fought that all my life, being able to get around. And now an electric wheelchair is the answer. It didn't rob me of my enthusiasm for sports, but it sure, it was just tough to live through it.
How do you get through something like that?
Well, you know, you got to remember what the time it was. Physical therapy was never heard of it, you know. And my legs needed straightening. Who did it? Well, my father. And he devised a way of putting bricks in a bucket and putting bucket on the bucket of bricks on my knees. And I'd sit with that for a length of time and try to get my knees straight, my legs straight. We did that, and outwardly I have no problems, but when you see me walk, or it is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to do it. You know, you got to take the bitter with the sweet.
Have you had occasion over the years to speak with either kids or people who have had to deal with physical disabilities?
No, I never did. No, nobody ever asked me to.
That's surprising.
Yeah, nobody ever asked me to. I have new hips, new knees. I've got everything new. So I've been through a lot of physical problems.
Are you surprised that your voice has held up so well?
I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad. I'm not surprised, because I still use it.
You mentioned your first radio job was in Fort Wayne. For WOWO. What were your duties there? Was it in sports or was it just general?
No, I did news. I did a talk show with a woman. And it was sports, essentially. The old Fort Wayne Zollner Pistons, forerunner of pro basketball in the state. I was enamored with them and their abilities, and I broadcast some of their away games by use of Western Union Telegraph.
Ah, so you weren't at the game.
Yeah, no, and did the best I could. And while I was trying to figure out what the tape said, I'd call a timeout and run a commercial and get it straightened out. Now, what happened? Yeah, it was very primitive.
That was pretty common then, though, wasn't it? I mean, Ronald Reagan didn't to do a game that you weren't actually at.
Well, you know, I lived in Waterloo, Iowa, I think I mentioned to you, and Des Moines, WHO, the announcer was Reagan, Dutch Reagan, and I just thought he was a wonderful announcer, and he was. I'd say of people that I had influenced me, he would be one.
I was going to ask, he was one of your influences, huh?
Yeah. I mean, influenced me to get into the business.
One of your professional breaks certainly was getting the opportunity to be the public address announcer at the Speedway. And from what I understand, that was just kind of a fluke occurrence.
Oh, yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't remember how in the world I got describing an event prior to the race. It was a tour of antique automobiles. And Tony Allman, the new owner, and Wilbur Shaw, the president, three-time winner, came up to me and asked me if I'd be interested in working race day. I said, sure. So they put me atop that old pagoda with you wavering in the wind up there. Very little information. I just ad-libbed my way through it.
So they asked you probably just, was it a couple of weeks before the race? Or?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Just 3 or 4 days.
Do you remember what they paid you that first year for doing that work? Nothing?
No. You remember Elmer George? He was a driver and married Tony Allman's daughter. I asked him about starting paying me, and he said, oh, people are always bugging us about getting paid, and if we had to pay everybody, we wouldn't have any money for the drivers.
So they thought you should just do this for free forever?
Yeah.
Wow.
Eventually, I got $100.
How long before they finally decided to pay you?
It was about 20 years.
20 years? Mm-hmm. So in the 1960s sometime, they started to pay you?
Yeah. And they started paying me $100 for the month, not just for the one day.
That was awfully generous of them. That's amazing. Because,
well, I enjoyed it.
But that's,
it was a thrill to be able to do it.
Well, the first race, which is what, 1946?
Yes.
this was the first race after the war, and the track had been shut down, and they had to, you know, get the weeds out of the track and everything. What do you remember from that first race in 1946?
Confusion. I remember the tremendous outpouring of fans, totally unexpected. And, of course, I began to take hold then and learn about the sport.
It still amazes me that the Speedway would have you work out there for 20 years and not pay you or maybe
No,
pay
it
you.
Was just recently that we began to get some good money.
Because it's not like they weren't making money. I mean, they were filling up that track every year.
Oh,
for the
race. They used to say that, hell, they had all the expenses for the year paid by early sales, you know.
But they never got around to paying.
They never got around to.
I'm surprised. I mean, Tony Holman.
Well, it was an honor. And it was an honor for me to do it. To think that I was working at the world's most famous racetrack, and there were benefits that came to me as a result, obviously.
It was exposure, certainly, for you. Were you a racing fan before you began doing that?
No, I had seen only one championship race, and that was at the State Fairgrounds in Illinois. Had an uncle who lived there, and he enjoyed them, so he took me one time when I was visiting, and I got to see that and thoroughly enjoyed it and thought it was thrilling, but that was the only time I'd seen a major race.
So those first years of working at the Speedway must have been difficult for you because you really didn't know what was going on, did you? Those first couple of years.
Well, certainly I was better than that. I knew it was a two-mile track.
Yeah, but
they
as far
were
as,
turning left.
As far as knowing
basically.
The drivers. And
well, a funny thing, though. Race day, 1946, up on the top up there, and the drivers had a driver's board where their car numbers were on it, sticking out from the pagoda. And that's how they knew who was in the first five positions. That's how I knew who was leading the race. That's the only communication I had with timing and scoring in that era. And George Hoster, who was a Ford dealer out in Broad Ripple, had been the chief announcer prior to that time. So he still was, and he just turned it over to me at the start of the race and says, take her, and I thought he was going to come back. He never did. So I'm stuck there, you know. I wish I had a tape of it now to see what in the world I said that day. Then I realized that I really couldn't see anything from the pagoda, and you still can't from the pagoda. And so I insisted that we get a better view of it by being on the outside of the track. And so we, the next year, had a press area and so forth built outside the track.
Along the main straightaway?
Along the main, right near the starting line. And that was much better. But I began to add to the staff, not only voices, but people to help me keep track of things. Always had somebody. Once we got equipment that showed who was leading and their speed and things like that, and whether or not it was a new track record or whatever, I hesitated to make statements like that. And unless I had an observer right with me, and then he'd give me a signal, and I'd go with it.
Did you have any interest or opportunity to become part of the Speedway radio network, or did you like what you were doing better?
Oh, I enjoyed what I was doing better.
More direct communication?
Well, I don't know. If I were doing it on that network, or I'd have been secondary, so I would have been stuck out on the second turn or, you know, on the backstretch or something. I wanted to be the chief, you know.
Sure.
That's why I stayed with. And I'm glad I did.
Carnegie sets a record of his own at the Speedway when this tribute episode of One on One continues. Welcome back to this tribute episode of One on One. I'm Mark Monteith. Tom Carnegie left his mark on the Indianapolis 500 in so many ways. Here he talks about his favorite race, his favorite drivers, how he managed to influence the Speedway's records book, and the jab he took at Andy Granatelli.
As you look back, you went to all the races back to 1946. Do you have like a favorite era, a certain time period when you enjoyed the race the most?
I'd say in the 1960s and 1970s. There was variety then. A lot of different types of chassis, different types of engines, all the way from the Novi to, you know, basic motorcycle engine.
And you had Andy Granatelli with the turbines.
Oh, yeah. So there was always something like that to talk about. Today, it's all the same. Same chassis everybody has. Same engine everybody has. So I like that era when things were different. When you go into Gasoline Alley and see them working on an engine, and you don't see that now. And I had time to get acquainted with people like Jim Clark. There's a story. Jim Clark was a Formula One champion. Came there, had a engine out, in the back instead of up front under the hood. Completely different philosophy about either they were going to go fast. And what a wonderful young man Jim Clark was. And if you asked me my two favorite drivers, they would be two different personalities. A.J. Foyt, who was an old meanie. He isn't today, but he was then. And Jim Clark. And the things you do when you're interested in somebody. He won the race, Jim did, and I didn't want to let it go. And I wanted to do a motion picture for television then about him. And I just got on the phone, called long distance to his sponsor, Humble Oil, down in Houston, and got acquainted with Mr. Gray, and he said, come on down and see me. So we did, went down, wanted to know how much it would cost, and I just sort of threw a dart on the wall and said $25,000. Went back, said to the station, we got $25,000 to go to Scotland, where he lived. And we did. Wound up going with a picture to a premier New York City, and it was running coast to coast on the old Dumont Network, in case you ever remember that. So it's, by sticking your neck out, it helps sometimes. I've forgotten what we called it.
Something like the Flying Scott, or...
That's it, Flying Scott.
The Flying Scott, I think I've heard of that.
And everybody was proud of it. You didn't know I was a record setter at the track, did you?
I don't think so.
Speed, talking about speed. Oh, yeah. This was... Rick Mears was driving for Roger Penske. And he was chasing, who's a driver from Michigan? Gordon Johncock. Gordy was leading. And 10 laps to go, he had a lead of 10 seconds. Everybody was getting, on edge and standing, and I was loving it. 9 laps, 9 seconds. 8 laps, 8 seconds. Get down, and Gordy Johncock won the race just by a fraction. And everybody cheering, and I was carried away, and I couldn't think of anything to say except, it's a new track record. So I had to verify it. So I called timing and scoring. And they said, well, we don't have that information for you. So I said, okay, talked to my friend George King, who was working next to me. I said, how does 1600 seconds sound to you? And he says, go with it. So I said, attention, everyone, it's a new track record, 1600ths of a second. After it was all over and the enthusiasm has died, I thought, oh, my gosh, what have I done? I've set a record, And then I didn't tell anybody because I didn't want to admit that. The next morning, there's a headline in the Indianapolis Star. It says, Johncock by 1600ths of a second, new track record, words to that effect. And I felt justified then. And I didn't really tell that story till 10 years later when that 1600s second was broken by Allinger Jr. and his competitor. That by that time, they got the information to me, and it was, I don't know, I'll say 32 thousandths of a second or something, and George was still sitting there, and I said, yep, there goes our record. I don't even want to announce this one. But I did.
But the 1600ths of a second, was that something you just pulled out of your head?
And they, yeah.
They had no way to verify?
No, I could have said, no, I could have said 16 thousandths of a second.
And nobody ever was able to go back and check?
They wouldn't have known, huh?
Nobody was ever able to go back and check?
Well, look in that record book. Just you'll see 1600s. There's a margin in the press book.
That's thanks to Tom Carnegie.
And that's my record. I'm no longer a record holder, though.
Well, you had a flair for the dramatic in your announcing. You know, you're well known for, you know, he's on it, and it's a new track record, this kind of thing. How did that kind of thing evolve?
Well, I began to realize, you know, I'd taken place in theater and plays and things like that, and you don't want a long sentence at a racetrack. You need a few words to put it across what you're trying to say, and words you can repeat. And that's just my style. Don't say, ladies and gentlemen, everyone, this looks like a new track record, but we'll check it, and yes, it is. And why, just come out with it. Say, it's a new track record. Or out of the fourth turn and onto the straightaway. All you got time for is three or four words. And repeat. The reason you repeat is because all the way around the track, they'll hear it at some place then.
Did you have dramatic training, theater training, or did you want to be an actor?
No, I did a lot of plays.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
When you were, in high school?
High school and college.
Did that help you?
I love theater.
Did you have ambitions of being an actor or something like that?
Well, no, it wouldn't have. You know, I could have tried. I would have been happy. But I decided to get married when I graduated, and I had to do something where I could get a job.
You were married in 1942.
Yes.
Right. And still married, we should mention. It must be a thrill to be speaking to hundreds of thousands of people that have that kind of audience.
It is.
Particularly when the race is coming down to the last lap, and
that's when you hope for a good finish.
Do you have a favorite race, a particular race that stands out the most in your memory?
Well, that race in 1982 with
Mears and Johncock.
Mears and Johncock, yes, that's my favorite race. They're favorite instances in other races, but that's my favorite race.
People always bring up Mario is slowing down. That became almost the... Probably didn't say it that many times.
That's sort of cornball, you know. It's just, they around town, they used to sell those punch board. Then they began to have them on what lap Mario would quit, you know. And I always said on the back stretch, and that's usually where it was, but it could be on the front stretch. I'd hear that engine going sour on the front stretch and wait till he got on the back stretch. So I just played to the audience on that one, having a little fun, you know. Yeah.
Do you miss your daily work at the track? I know you still go out, but do you miss the day-to-day activity?
Well, I do. I felt it was time to quit, but I go out every day. Every day there's activity. And I have a lot of friends out there. I have a lot of friends in the business. So I have something to do. It isn't as if I don't anymore. And I can go back home and criticize what I saw or heard, rather, but I don't tell people.
You mentioned earlier that you thought the 60s and 70s were the most enjoyable, the most colorful time. Today, it seems like all the cars are the same. There aren't as many American drivers. It seems so homogenized. Do you see it that way?
Oh, I do.
How did it become that way?
Well, I think by robbing the event of its ingenuity, like building your own engine, building your own race car. That's just an example of why it's all the same.
Have they reached the technological limits? I mean, is it...
Well, what they did was they felt they reached the limits for safety, and then it got so expensive that it was cheaper to buy the engines, and I don't know. And then you don't have the opportunity to set new speed records.
Right.
We haven't had a new speed record since Ari Leyendijk set it. But we were knocking off new speed records all the time. And that was what was interesting. 150, 200, 100. Those were amazing accomplishments. The ones that did that were brave, and it was fun to see that. And so when you went to qualifying, you could see a new track record before the day was over. And you don't see that now.
Do you wish they would lift the technological barriers and just let anything go?
Well, one of the good drivers through the years told me one day, he said, "Tom, what they ought to let you drive is what you're big enough to drive, not all these rules." And so that's one thought, that you're big enough to drive. And I sort of agree with him.
Yeah. I would imagine one of the most difficult things about what you did there was when a driver was killed.
Oh, yes. Yeah. 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 You just hoped you had the... it's interesting, in the beginning, in the early, early days, if there was a death at the racetrack, you weren't allowed to announce it. Wait for the newspapers to be sold outside to let the fans know. And I thought that was wrong. So I got it changed, and fortunately the safety of the speedway has improved. Everything has improved in regard to driver safety. So that challenge isn't there anymore, hopefully. And that I like.
Do you remember the first death you were able to announce?
Well, it was the McDonald
Sachs
event.
Early 60s.
Yes.
That was a terrible thing.
And, of course, you didn't know really the magnitude of it, how many cars were involved and all the facts about it, and, you know, and whether pedestrians or spectators were involved, because that was a conflagration that was just amazing after it was over.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you look at the field, and when they climb back in the cars an hour or so later, and here we go with all that carnage behind them, and you think, golly, they just are brave people. It's just amazing that the drivers and their teams would want to get back out there. I couldn't believe it, you know.
Yeah.
Move out with such alacrity. Just unbelievable to me how anybody could be that brave. And it's still a mark of courage to go at whatever speed they're going now. It's still competition. The only thing I'm saying is the rules limiting speed perhaps need to be looked at.
Bring back some technology.
Mm-hmm.
Some innovation.
Yeah.
You mentioned your favorite drivers as Jimmy Clark and A.J. Foyt. Who are some of the other more memorable characters that you ran across that you enjoyed dealing with over the years at the track?
Well, of course, I had Granatelli. A big-time operator. He came there, didn't have anything. One of those Chicago hoods that came down there, and he didn't have much going for him for a while. But he matured, and so did the family, and then they invent this product, and so he's now a car owner. I remember he wrote a book called They Call Me Mr. 500. I sort of resented it, because to me, Tony Holman was Mr. 500, if anybody was. So it was a rainy day, and I got Andy to sit on the pit wall with me and do an interview. He told me about the book, and he said it's number one on the New York Times sales list. And so I said, well, which list, fiction or nonfiction? And he didn't like that.
He didn't like that?
No.
That's good.
It was good at the time, and that's something that just came out. I didn't plotted or planted.
That's good for
and
them
to needle him a little.
Carnegie relives the pioneering days of local television and his calls of the state high school basketball tournament when this tribute episode of One on One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here, bringing back my conversation with Tom Carnegie from May of 2009. Carnegie's best known for his work at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but he reached millions of basketball fans over the years with his calls of the state high school tournament as well.
Let's talk about your television career. You started working for Channel 6 in what year? In the late
1953.
How long had it been on the air at that point?
Well, they went on the air in 1949.
So what your duties there, was it just reading the sports news on a 6 o'clock newscast or whatever?
Oh, yeah. You just had to do a lot of ad-libbing. You know, you didn't have time to type it out.
But you were doing radio and television at the same time?
Yes. Yeah.
And was it mostly, like in television, you weren't going out to events and doing live shots from games or anything, so you were mostly in the studio?
Yes,
reading?
Mostly in the studio.
Do you think it was more fun then than it is now?
No, it was a great challenge, but you didn't know it was a big challenge. As you look back on it, it was a challenge, but you weren't aware of it. That's just where the industry was. That's what we had to work with. Didn't have teleprompters for a long time, for example. That's just one example. And we had film. When we started, we had one cameraman, and he'd go out and take pictures, and then take it to a photo shop out on 46th Street, and get it developed, and bring it back, and that was our film for the day.
Wow. You mean like at the race or something like that, at the track?
Yeah, whatever he could pick up, you know. Primitive, yes.
You must have had, though, quite a work day. If you're doing radio and television, that must have been quite a work day.
Well, it was, yeah.
And also to do your work at the track, at the Speedway.
Yeah, yeah.
Had some long days.
Long weeks. Many a seven-day week. Many. If there wasn't a full day on Saturday or a full day on Sunday, it was got to come down, do a 15-minute radio show or Jack Mollenkopf football.
You began doing the state high school basketball tournament in what year?
Well, it would have been 1953.
53, from the very beginning, from you, when you worked there. And did it up through when, the 1970s sometime?
25 years, whatever that was.
I have memories as a kid growing up in Indianapolis listening to you and Tony Hinkle.
Yeah.
Doing the high school tournament games.
Yeah, Tony Hinkle was coach at Butler and athletic director and chief groundskeeper, everything.
You know? Yeah. He was not a trained broadcaster. I have a weird memory of him. You're doing a game, and there's a little pause or something, and this is in the late 60s, and some guy walked in front of you, I guess, with long hair, and Tony Hinkle says on the air, "Look at that kid. He must be a hippie or something." I mean, I think anything would come out of his mouth.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful man.
What about the state tournament? What games stand out in your memory from those?
I think game where Manuel.
Manuel Kokomo?
Manuel Kokomo played.
1961.
Yeah. I figured Manuel was going to win it with the Van Arsdale twins. Just mentally, you know, I try to play it right down the line and don't show favoritism. All of a sudden, the lead disappeared that Manuel had, and Kokomo winds up winning it. And I go back to Indianapolis and go with the Manuel team as they went to a Southside restaurant and hope for to have a victory dinner, but, you know, we're just commiserate together. And that caused a lot of trouble up Kokomo. Everybody thought I was prejudiced, see, because I didn't go to Kokomo to celebrate.
You also then broadcast Attucks' state championship.
Yes, yes.
And it's amazing to me that it took all of those years before an Indianapolis team won the state championship. Because that tournament began in 1911.
Mm-hmm.
What do you recall from that, the significance of Attucks winning?
Well, I think the significance was that here was a team from Indianapolis that was so dominant and so much talent that people sort of resented it, you know, that, gosh, how can anybody be that good? I made talks at Christmas Attucks school. They had great coaching. It was a shock to people in the state that here this black team can come through and be that good, that disciplined.
It opened some eyes.
I think that's the way to say it.
I've heard conflicting things. I've heard that people in Indianapolis were thrilled that an Indianapolis school won and they ignored color, and I've also heard, though, that a lot of people here didn't want them to win and resented it or whatever. What do you recall from the public reaction?
I'd say that thought is right.
That people resented it?
That there were some people that resented it.
We should go back.
And why, I don't know, but they did.
Well, that was the times. We should go back briefly. Before Attucks, you were broadcasting games of the Indianapolis Kautskis on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
This is a professional team that a lot of people wouldn't even be aware of. They played here from 1932 up until the late 40s, and you did their games on radio. Frank Kautsky was the owner. He owned a grocery store on the
around,
south side.
Yeah. That's when George Mikan showed up, and we'd fill the Butler Fieldhouse with fans. That was quite an era. Well, it was an all-white team.
Yeah.
And pretty much an all-white league.
Like at that time it was, yes. But, they would occasionally fill up Butler. The Kautskis, the Olympians, would occasionally fill up Butler Fieldhouse.
Oh, yes.
For professional basketball.
Yeah, they did. And I remember Frank Kautsky, they signed Bill Kloss out of Rice Institute for $10,000. Oh, Frank says, you were paying him all that money, and we don't even know if he can throw the ball in Lake Erie.
Tom Carnegie talks of the accomplishment he was most proud of, one that few people are aware of, and reveals his unusual recurring dream when this tribute episode of One on One continues. We're back on One on One. I'm Mark Monteith, paying tribute today to local broadcasting legend Tom Carnegie. One of his greatest accomplishments was one that many people weren't even aware of. He'll explain.
You know, you look back on, you know, I'm, gosh, almost 90 now. You look back on these glamorous, wonderful days that I've been a part of. The one thing that I'm real proud of, that people really don't know, and that's fine with me, but was that I established the Indiana Basketball Hall of Fame. And you look back on a wonderful museum over there in Newcastle, Indiana. You look at a wonderful staff that operates it, and I'm proudest of that. Another group that I organized was the 500 Old Timers. It has over 1,000 members now. Money in the bank, active.
How did you go about forming the Hall of Fame? How did that come about?
Well, the manager of the station, Eldon Camel, just gave me time to do it. One time, the Lions Club asked me to put a program on. And so I somehow knew people up at Frankfurt. The coach, Case, up there. You know, he was the coach when they won the state championship. And so at the Lions Club, I got several players from that team, Frankfurt State Championship team,
they won
anniversary.
1936, they won the state championship. Yeah.
Yeah. 25 years later. And I had them come down to the Claypool Hotel where the luncheon was. And they really enjoyed it. I thought, you know, but then that began, that planted the seed, that one show.
So you started talking to people about raising money for
the
Hall
of
Fame?
And then I was close to the people at Peter Eckrich in Fort Wayne. And I went up and said, you know, this is what I'd like to do. They said, well, we'll help financially. So they gave me $10,000. It was a good way to start it. So I worked on that.
The original Hall of Fame was in Indianapolis.
Well, yes. But, you know, in Indianapolis, you're competing with, you know, too many other things. And when they started, you know, we wanted to expand, and people began quoting so much rent a square foot, it was just too costly to stay in Indianapolis. And so we opened it up for a bid. Newcastle, the bank over there, Mariana Bank, gave us some beautiful property, and away we go. I would say, looking back, those are the two things that I am proudest of.
You were an age group swimming champion, is that correct?
Yes.
How did that come about?
I didn't know you knew that.
I remember hearing that.
I could go get my medal and show you that, and I did. I wanted to keep in shape, and my legs weren't good. I couldn't walk without falling on occasion, that kind of thing, and just an effort to keep in shape. So I took up swimming at the new pool there at IUPUI. And the coaches and everybody were very helpful to me, and so I'd go over there during the day and do laps. Then I entered, naturally I'm going to enter the senior events.
How old are you at this point?
About 55. It's the 6C long in there. I didn't resume after I had two knee replacements. It just seemed like, I don't know, the knees were so precious to me that I was afraid I'd mess them up. And I had two hips replaced, and so I just spent too much time in the hospital to get back in there. I think that senior program is wonderful, and I enjoyed learning how to do it. And I won a few events, so that satisfied my ego.
Were these like national events? Were you?
No, just statewide.
Okay. Had you been a swimmer as a kid?
No, not really. But I lived near a lake, and so I could always swim. Never competitive.
Well, that must have been satisfying to do something athletic like that.
That's
after,
right.
After announcing sports events for so long, to do something athletic.
And I transferred it into covering the diving and covering swimming events as they came to the new facility there on the campus. So I transferred it into knowledge of the features.
I have to believe you have been asked endlessly over the years to do voiceover work or various things.
Yeah,
like
at times.
Probably.
But I haven't gone after it.
Yeah.
I've never had an agent or anything like that. I've done it, but it's usually more to help some new company.
Do a lot of it for free?
Yes.
You've done a lot of things in your life that you didn't get paid for, haven't you?
That's right. I guess so, but, you know, I don't measure things that way. Never have.
Well, here's a question. This is a question I've asked everybody. It's off the wall, but what do you dream about at night when you're sleeping? Do you dream about doing the race, your public address
announcement? No, I don't dream about things that I'm involved in ordinarily. Lots of times I think about, I love to play baseball. I would envision myself playing baseball for the L.A. Dodgers. But my favorite team is the St. Louis Cardinals. And, but I'm never good enough to make that team, apparently.
In your dreams?
But I started off as a catcher, and I loved baseball.
Did you play minor league baseball as a catcher?
Well, I started to go down to Springfield in the 3I League. But I never made it.
Okay.
I mean, I just got sick because I still follow the Cardinals every day.
You dream of playing for the L.A. Dodgers, huh?
Yeah. You know, and why the Dodgers, I don't know, except that I followed them before they ever moved out there. And my wife, that was her favorite team. But I don't know why I picked California. I've never been that impressed with California.
Do you play well?
Yeah, to the point of the owners real happy that they have me and, you know, that kind. Bite me up to the press box.
Funny.
It is, isn't it?
One-on-One's tribute to Tom Carnegie returns in a moment. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. So, what do you think? Did the Speedway get its money's worth out of Tom Carnegie all those years? Hard to believe it took so long for the people there to get around to actually paying him for his work. But you have to give him credit, because he did it for the love. I had personal experience with his generosity one year as well, when I organized a small reunion of the professional basketball players from the 1940s, who were members of the Indianapolis Kautskis. Carnegie announced their games on radio, and I invited him to come out as well. He not only came, he emceed the evening, and didn't take a dime from me either. That was Tom Carnegie, a man who donated his talents to all kinds of organizations over the years. The Speedway certainly won't be the same without him, but his voice will live forever. Now, remember, if you missed parts of this conversation or want to hear one of the others in the One-on-One series, they're all available on the website at 1070thefan.com. Just click on the One-on-One window at the bottom of the homepage, and the podcasts await you. And if you want to email me, the address is mark at 1070thefan.com. And I'll be back next week with another conversation with an Indiana sports personality right here on 1070 The Fan.
And a new four-lap record. It is a new track record.